Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Michael Bach Atlas.
And welcome back, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you. We're going to be talking today with Dr. Brian Fallon, Professor of Clinical Psychiatry and Director of the Lyme and Tick-Borne Disease Research Center, about a new book he's co-authored called Conquering Lyme Disease, Science Bridges the Great Divide. You ever get questions about Lyme disease or tick disease?
Pretty often, actually, especially, you know, people in North Carolina think that it's a lot more common than it really is.
But tick-borne diseases are common.
They are.
But we have to think about beyond Lyme disease, we have to think about some weird things like Rocky Mountain spotted fever. We have ehrlichiosis. But this is kind of interesting because where he's doing his research is that middle ground between what is known and what is not known. Because we know there's a lot of things like people who think and worry about chronic Lyme disease.
That's very true.
So we'll get a chance to talk about that. But first, we're going to talk about some research that matters. And I think the very first one is about what's happening in our schools and health and nurses in this particular research.
There's a new state report that came out, Adam, that said that there are so few nurses in North Carolina's public schools that it would cost an additional $49 million to $79 million a year to help meet our students' needs, which is pretty astonishing.
This is really important because when you look at the statistics that there's only one nurse for every 1,000 students that are coming to school, and many of these nurses have to cover two or three schools at a time.
And sometimes that ratio is even higher. Even in Wake County, it's closer to 1 to 1,700 students.
That's really kind of impossible. And particularly when you think about the increase in chronic diseases that children have, their parents have, and so what they're being asked to do. And we're not even talking about the burden of mental health conditions that these children have. And it seems like to me that a wise investment would say we need to have more healthcare providers in schools as resources for the children.
Completely agree. The National Association of School Nurses recommends having a registered nurse at every school, which I think may be a long ways off. And if we can just decrease that ratio for nurses to students, I think the students would be better off.
And I think this is a problem actually probably of most states in school districts. And I was really interested. My brother-in-law, Michael, is a lawyer in Atlanta who really heads the Coalition for Free Legal Aid for people across Atlanta. And he was talking about a really innovative program where attorneys are also being co-located in schools because of the number of difficult legal things that kids and parents and families are facing. So the school has been called upon to do more. They need more resources.
I think the key word here is collaboration among everybody.
Good idea. Well, speaking of collaboration, our next research that matters. I'm not so certain that it is collaboration, but it's the answer probably is collaboration. What are we talking about?
So we're talking here about politics. Not really, but it's stressing out our youth, apparently, America's youth.
It's stressing me out, too.
It's stressing me out as well. So the American Psychological Association actually conducted a survey of about 80 youth across the country, and they found that a majority experienced physical or emotional distress before and even after the 2016 election.
This was like a qualitative interviews with these kids, and they were saying things like, I can't sleep. It's been hard to concentrate. I feel like I could get killed any second. And the consequences of those types of reactions are really, really not good.
And like we talked about in our last article about schools and nurses and even rising mental health rates, between 2005 and 2014, rates of depression increased for adolescents, and that was similarly observed for anxiety disorders as well.
And this, lest anyone think, is not for any particular candidate. So even those who voted for a losing candidate or a winning candidate had real distress because of the 24-hour news cycle, all the things that are coming at them. And I guess the question, and really we go back to maybe our last article, Michael, about the need for having better resources in schools, in families, for mental health to really help them understand this 24-hour news cycle isn't really healthy for any of us.
Agree.
Well, the third research that matters is the awareness of the Holocaust, which is, of course, is very personal to you and I because of our faith, but also is personal and relevant to everyone on this planet.
And this is, I think, really interesting. So survivors of Auschwitz returned to the camp back in January of 2017 on the 72nd anniversary of its liberation. And in a recent survey, 41% of American adults did not know what Auschwitz was.
Yeah, and it goes really beyond that because a third of Americans, including a greater percentage of millennials, thought, well, there were 2 million or fewer Jews that were killed in the Holocaust, and the actual number is 6 million. And only 40% of Americans know that Hitler was actually democratically elected. This isn't necessarily anti-Semitism occurring here, but what it is a fading of memory. People do think that the Holocaust should be taught in schools and that really people want to have this, but with only 400,000 Holocaust survivors still living, there's a real risk here.
What I was optimistic about, Adam, was that an overwhelming consensus, 93%, again, like you said, believe that students should learn about the Holocaust, but that Holocaust denial in the United States is actually more of a rare event, with 96% of respondents saying they believe that the Holocaust happened. And I know that internationally that this is certainly less common.
The thing I fear, Michael, is that there will be those from the perhaps far right, those who have neo-Nazi views, may try to say fake news and start a rewrite. And so whereas the memory may fade, the ability to think about these things may be diminished. So I think we have to recommit in school systems across the country that there should be some mandatory teaching of this because of its impact on society. Last research that matters has to do with tax refunds. And in this particular case, we say, how do tax refunds impact health? Well, Michael's going to tell you.
Yes. So those who filed earliest and received their refund in February put a large majority of percentage of their spending towards paying for deferred care, about 65%. So we have a lot of individuals who are getting those tax refunds earlier who are actually having to take care of their own health with this.
Yeah. And this appeared to be much worse for women, for younger people, who perhaps were delaying it even more and were paying even more of their health refunds towards these issues. I mean, we know that healthcare as a percentage of our gross national product is twice that of virtually any other country in the world, and almost 20 cents on the dollar of every dollar. And here, this is really takes it home on the refunds. It's essentially an equivalent of almost 50 to 60% of that dollar.
And
unbelievable.
I think it's important to put that in perspective that there are some other countries, particularly just to the north of us in Canada, that they pay higher tax rates throughout the year, but they do get a little bit more maybe in terms of social services and including healthcare, which I think is important to keep in mind.
Yeah. So what do we do with this? Well, I think we raise issues today. A lot of times research that matters, we have things that you can do, our listeners can do that maybe improve health, maybe stop doing that, improve health. I think these are the kinds of questions we raise today that are ones we hope our listeners will have discussions because we think these are important issues.
I agree, Adam, and I think awareness is key.
Well, that'll conclude the research that matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll hear a recent interview we had with Dr. Brian Fallon, professor of clinical psychiatry and director of the Lyme and Tick-Borne Diseases Research Center, about a new book he wrote called Conquering Lyme Disease, Science Bridges the Great Divide. You're listening to Your Health. We'll be right back. Stay with us. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Today on Conversations, we're talking with Dr. Brian Fallon, professor of clinical psychiatry and director of the Lyme and Tick-Borne Disease Research Center, about Conquering Lyme Disease, Science Bridges the Great Divide, a new book he co-authored about this disease. Welcome, Dr. Fallon.
Thank you so much.
You know, it's really great to have you on the show, and this is an issue that I think will resonate to listeners of Your Health really across the country. Tell us before we get started, though, a little bit about yourself. How did you come to be an expert about Lyme disease? Because I don't think most people would assume that You've been interested in infectious disease your entire life, which may be true, but may not.
No, you are absolutely right. When I was in medical school, I had very little to no interest in infectious disease because I was planning to become a psychiatrist, and I thought, why would I need to know about infectious diseases? So I was quite taken aback when I finished my fellowship at the Columbia University Medical Center in the Department of Psychiatry. I had just done a biological psychiatry research fellowship. I was starting my work with patients who had severe obsessive compulsive disorder and other obsessional disorders, and I started getting referred some patients who were told that they were hypochondriacs, and I felt that they probably weren't, and that they had some kind of a medical illness that hadn't been figured out yet. At the same time, I live in Connecticut. I work in New York. I'm surrounded by ticks. I'm surrounded by deer in the yard, and Lyme disease is epidemic throughout the United States, but particularly here in the Northeast and along the Atlantic coast. So we have a major problem, and I started to learn as a result of some of my family members who got sick that this is not a simple illness by any means, nor is it an easy illness to understand. Now, as a psychiatrist, I got called, and my wife is a psychiatrist actually also, and she works at Yale, and she and I both got called by Polly Murray, who was the mother in Old Lyme, Connecticut, who first brought Lyme disease to the attention of public health officials in Connecticut because she noticed in her town that there was an unusual clustering of kids with arthritis. And they were being diagnosed with juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, and she knew that you shouldn't have a clustering of that. And so finally the public health authorities paid attention and they brought out epidemiologists from Yale to investigate. That led to the identification of Lyme arthritis. Well, years later, this is like 1990, she heard that there were two psychiatrists who had an interest in Lyme disease. She called us and said, you know, you guys should study the psychiatric aspects of this illness because I think it causes that because a lot of my neighbors with Lyme disease are getting problems. They're getting problems with their memory. They can't find the words to say what they want to say. They're depressed and irritable. So that is what started our journey of focusing on neuropsychiatric Lyme disease.
You are really at the intersection between what is known and what is not known about Lyme disease. And I wonder if you could maybe just help our listeners who probably have heard of Lyme disease. What exactly is Lyme disease?
Well, Lyme disease is an infectious illness. So it's caused by an infection, this spirochete called Borrelia burgdorferi, and it's a bacterial infection, so you can treat it with antibiotics, and it's transmitted by the bite of a specific kind of tick. It's commonly known as the deer tick. When the tick bites you, it injects whatever is in its abdominal contents into the skin. And when that happens, you'll get a local irritation. And if the spirochetes are present, you'll get an enlarging rash. And that often looks like a red circle or a red rounded area. Sometimes it looks like a bullseye. And that's what's called the Lyme rash or the erythema migrans rash. Now, shortly thereafter, it can enter the bloodstream, and then it goes wherever the blood might go. So it can go up to the meninges, which surround the brain, causing a meningitis. It can go to the joints, causing an arthritis. It can go to the heart, causing a conduction block. Now, when it goes to the heart, you can have a very serious problem because if the electrical conduction is blocked and you get what's called a complete block, you could potentially die. So it can be a life-threatening situation. And interestingly, for reasons we don't quite understand, that seems to afflict younger people under the age of 30 more than older people. So it's a fascinating disease in that it can affect so many different parts of the body and have many different manifestations. When it affects the brain or causes the meningitis, you get like a rip-roaring severe headache, stiff neck. You might feel nauseous. You might have problems with your vision. A whole bunch of things can happen. When it goes into the brain, you can get what's called an encephalitis, where you can get confused. I saw a patient once who his first manifestation of encephalitis was a paranoia. So he thought people were following him. So he had a psychiatric manifestation as the initial sign. Now that's rare, but it just shows that Lyme disease can be a tricky illness at times to diagnose because it has so many different manifestations. The classic signs, symptoms, though, however, are most commonly the rash, severe fatigue that comes after the rash, joint pains and muscle pains, some word-finding problems, maybe some shooting pains or sharp stabbing pains or burning pains. So those are some of the classic symptoms along with headaches.
As a family doctor, you know, when we typically see it getting warmer and we start hearing or seeing or feeling ticks on ourselves, we know that anyone who comes in with a headache or fever or this rash that could even remotely resemble, we're going to treat them for Lyme disease. Sometimes we could think about Rocky Mountain spotted fever, another tick-borne illness. And almost everyone gets better with a pretty simple antibiotic. So what's the big deal here? What are family doctors and or patients missing in this kind of common area?
That's a great point. A lot of people think that Lyme disease is a simple illness because when you treat it at the time of the rash, by and large, almost everybody gets better. So maybe 90, 95% of people have no problems afterwards. So that's good. Doxycycline or amoxicillin, those are standard antibiotics, and they work very well. So because most of the researchers in the country early on were focused on studying patients with early Lyme disease, they didn't believe that patients were developing chronic problems. They didn't believe that these patients who presented with chronic fatigue-like symptoms or fibromyalgia-like pain or cognitive problems with short-term memory issues or brain fog, they didn't believe that those had anything to do with Lyme disease because in their experience, and it's totally legitimate, in their experience, patients did very well. The problem is that you may not see the rash. And if you don't see the rash, then it may go undetected. You may have a subtle flu-like illness and not even know that you got bitten by a tick. And then maybe months later, you suddenly develop a swollen joint or you develop other problems that are manifestations of Lyme disease. But even Lyme disease may not even be considered at that point because you don't recall the tick bite and you never saw the rash. And there's lots of studies now that show that delays in diagnosis lead to a greater difficulty in recovering from the illness with the standard antibiotic treatment. Now, the standard antibiotic treatment is roughly 2 to 3 weeks of oral antibiotics. But the question that emerges, and it's something that we've been studying for the last couple of decades, is what do you do with those patients who have relapsing symptoms? Do you treat them with another course of antibiotics? Do they get better? Can we identify biomarkers that will tell us who needs the antibiotics and who don't? Do some patients have changes in their brain chemistry as a result of the prior Lyme infection that now requires brain-focused treatments as opposed to antibiotics? So there's a whole range of questions that are much more challenging when you're working with the patients who have chronic symptoms than if you're faced with someone who simply has the early rash.
We want the answers. You got to.
I know it.
We got to take a short break.
Okay.
And then we come back, we're going to get all the answers. But no, we're going to continue talking with Dr. Brian Fallon, Professor of Clinical Psychiatry and Director of the Lyme and Tick-Borne Disease Research Center, about his new book, Conquering Lyme Disease, Science Bridges the Great Divide. We'll be right back with your health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of your health.
Welcome back. You've been listening to Your Health, and we've been talking with Dr. Brian Fallon, Professor of Clinical Psychiatry and Director of the Lyme and Tick-Borne Research Center at Columbia, about Conquering Lyme Disease, a new book about science bridging the great divide. And Dr. Fallon, right before the break, you really were honing us in to understand that there are a subset of people, not necessarily small, even if it's only 5% of hundreds of thousands, that becomes a large number, who may not respond to the initial treatment or may have delays in diagnosis. Which also begs the question, if I'm a patient, what type of diagnostic test do I need to get, or should I just get treated?
Well, that's a great question. So first of all, if you see the rash, go to your physician, The physician has to really ask you about where you've been, whether you've been exposed to ticks, but most likely that will be recognized as a Lyme rash, and the physician should treat you with antibiotics at that time, because early on in the course of Lyme disease, the tests are more often negative than they're positive. So a physician who says, we're going to wait to see what the blood test shows, that's not a good recommendation when you're faced with someone who's been to an area where there are ticks and there's a typical expanding Lyme rash. Later on in the course of illness, the diagnostic tests can be very helpful because they can tell you whether there are antibodies there that reflect exposure to the Lyme organism. The problem is that those antibody-based tests are not perfect. So some patients will have Lyme disease and they may test negative on those tests. That's been well established. Another problem with those tests is that they can stay positive for years after you've been treated successfully for Lyme disease. And these poor patients, they go to the doctor, they have a positive blood test, and even if they're feeling perfectly healthy, they're wondering, should I get treated for Lyme disease because my blood test is positive? So these antibody-based tests, number one, they're insufficiently sensitive, so some people who have Lyme disease will test negative. And secondly, they will stay positive for years once positive, so that you don't know whether or not the organism is still in your blood.
Which creates a diagnostic dilemma for the doctor to know when to retreat and when to retreat, and the medical text kind of poo-poo a lot of that, don't they?
That's exactly right. There's a tremendous controversy that's been raging in the medical field over the last two decades, which is, do you retreat patients who have relapsed? And based on my own research, we did an NIH-funded trial, and based on the research of others, I'm one who believes that retreatments can be helpful for patients. Now, I also am fully aware that there's a substantial group of patients who have been retreated who still have persistent symptoms, and then you need to do other things to try to help those patients. So the big conundrum for patients as well as their doctors is there a possibility that persistent infection is still present and therefore antibiotics are needed, or is it a post-infectious problem that needs another approach? Another issue, which I just want to bring up so that we cover it, which is that these ticks, they carry more than the agents of Lyme disease. So for example, a new microbe was discovered about 4 years ago called Borrelia miyamotoi, which causes an exact same cluster of symptoms as Lyme disease causes, but the blood tests for Lyme disease will be negative, and you will not develop a rash. So you live in a Lyme endemic area, you develop Lyme-like symptoms, you go to your doctor because you think you have Lyme disease, but you don't recall the rash and your blood tests are negative. And so the doctor says, well, you don't have Lyme disease. You must be tired, or you must be stressed, or you must have fibromyalgia or chronic fatigue or something else. Whereas if the doctor tested you for Borrelia miyamotoi, which most doctors don't do because they don't even know that exists as a problem, that might come back positive. In that situation, antibiotics would be prescribed because that is an effective treatment against Borrelia miyamotoi. There are other microbes that the ticks carry as well. So Powassan virus, that is a terrifying virus in many ways because it can cause death in 10% of cases of individuals who have the neurological syndrome of Powassan virus. Fortunately, cases of Powassan virus disease in the United States are rare. But I guess the point is that I'm making, which is we need to be very concerned about ticks. We need to be careful if we're going into tick-infested areas to engage in good prevention strategies. Now, we put a big chapter in our book on prevention because that is number one.
What are the top three sorts of things that people should consider that they maybe don't consider in terms of prevention?
Well, number one, if you're visiting a relative in a Lyme-infested area or you live in a Lyme-infested area, be aware of ticks. If you're walking through the woods, stay on the path, as opposed to going through the leaves. The ticks like to cluster under leaves. Don't walk through bushes because the ticks hang out in the areas where the mice are, and they're in the bushes. That's number one. Number two, it's helpful if you're going to be walking in these tick-infested areas to tuck your pants into your socks. It sounds totally absurd. You feel like a British explorer when you're doing this. But I'll tell you, at Easter time this year, I was walking around the house in Long Island where I was at with my pants in my socks, because that particular area of Long Island in New York is loaded with ticks that carry Lyme disease. And the previous year, 5 or 6 people in the family got tick bites. So it's absurd how terribly infested some of these areas are. You can also put a tick repellent on your skin that has DEET if you're going into a tick-infested area. Another really good thing is permethrin-infused clothing, which actually not only repels ticks, but it kills ticks. And that actually can stay on your clothing for like 30 or 40 washes.
This is a chemical from the chrysanthemum
family.
That's
right. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And you can spray your clothes at the beginning of the season, and you could, you know, just wear those socks. You could even spray your shoes.
Let me ask you a question, because I know you have a Lyme and tick-borne disease research center. Could you just give us really briefly a flavor of the sort of work you're doing? Give us maybe a case that you might be doing research on.
Well, I'll give you an example. Yesterday, somebody came to our office to participate in one of our protocols. And right now, we're collecting blood from patients with new onset Lyme disease. So she came in. She had recently had a tick bite. She had a rash. We looked closely at her rash, and it was a local irritation. It really didn't look like a expanding 2-inch or greater Lyme rash. And so she actually was not eligible for the study because she didn't actually have Lyme disease. All she had was the tick bite from a Lyme endemic area, and she didn't have any systemic symptoms. But why are we collecting those blood samples? We're collecting blood samples from people at different stages of Lyme disease, whether it's post-treatment Lyme disease, which some people also call chronic Lyme disease, or early Lyme disease. And we're storing them in a minus 80 freezer, which is a very cold freezer. And we're doing this so that we can collaborate with researchers both at Columbia as well as around the country to take advantage of the tremendous biotechnology that exists now. So they can probe the genome super fast. They can look at what's called the proteome, which are pieces of the protein in body fluids. They can look at the metabolome, which is the whole cluster of different things that of metabolites that are in the blood. And with these new approaches, they can actually create new diagnostic tests that are more sensitive. Hopefully, they can create tests that will become negative after a person is treated, showing that the infection is gone. There is a metabolomic study that suggests that that can indeed happen. They can find biomarkers. For example, one thing I do treatment studies. So I like to treat patients, and then hopefully we'll be able to identify biomarkers or things in the blood or things in the spinal fluid that might actually tell us, is this a person who's likely to respond to an additional course of antibiotics, or is this someone who needs something else? We're also doing brain imaging scans at our Lyme Center at Columbia because we believe that the brain is actually altered in a number of patients, and that is contributing to their persistent pain as well as their persistent fatigue and their cognitive problems. And if we can identify the areas of the brain that are affected, we can then perhaps target treatments to those areas. So, for example, transcranial magnetic stimulation is a magnetic way of stimulating the brain by just putting these magnetic devices on your scalp. And that has been shown, actually, to be helpful in improving mood as well as in reducing pain. So finding the right treatment for the right patient is the goal of precision medicine, as we all know. And it's a very exciting time right now in Lyme disease. Let me share with you that 10 years ago, 15 years ago, it was a nasty thing to have Lyme disease. It's still nasty. But it was even worse then because there was so much conflict and so much fighting in the medical community about Lyme disease. The last 5 to 10 years have seen a tremendous openness to a greater understanding of Lyme disease. And it's largely because of wonderful animal model studies that have shown that the spirochete, the bacterium that causes Lyme disease, can persist in a mouse, in a dog, in a monkey, even after antibiotic treatment. Now, you think that's bad news, but it's actually good news because that means we have an animal model to study the problem of persistent infection. And so right now, there are a lot of people focused on this and trying to understand if you do have a small number of persistent Lyme spirochetes, are those spirochetes actually causing symptoms? Or are they causing disease, or are they just there? You know, one thing that I didn't appreciate when I first came into this world of infectious disease is that we have 10 times more microbes in our body than we have human cells. So you know, the goal in life as a physician, as you know, is not to eradicate all the bugs in our body, because we would die if we tried to do that. We need to live in harmony and synchrony with these microbes. But certainly if you have some of these dangerous microbes that these ticks carry, you need to give the immune system a really good, strong chance of conquering the infection by treating it with the appropriate antibiotics.
The title of the book, Conquering Lyme Disease, Science Bridging the Great Divide. You're talking science, and you're talking the age-old adage of a physician, which is to offer hope. And I appreciate really you bringing your work, your expertise, your passion, and compassion to your health listeners. We're going to put a copy of the link to your book up on our website so that our listeners can purchase it. And it sounds like there's a wealth of material in there that 5 to 10 years from now, you'll be ready for volume two.
Thank you. And we have a website too, which is www.columbia-lyme.org.
We want to thank you very much, Dr. Brian Fallon, Professor of Clinical Psychiatry at Columbia and Director of the Lyme and Tick-Borne Disease Research Center. Congratulations on your new book, Conquering Lyme Disease.
Thanks so much, Adam. I really appreciate it.
We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Calls segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. And Laura, if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. Let's dive right in. And what's our very first house call from a listener?
The first one is, my daughter has irritable bowel syndrome and her pediatrician said to take a probiotic daily. She continues to have alternating loose stools and constipation. We follow a gluten-free diet, but that does not seem to do much. She has no other pain, but we're wondering if she should see a gastroenterologist.
Well, there are so many things going on here that are really important. First off, we have something that's irritable bowel disease that tends to affect adults more than kids, but can affect kids. And this could be a teenager, we don't know. And sounds like you actually have a primary care provider that does know something clearly about irritable bowel syndrome. They may be trying some probiotics.
Right.
Maybe they're trying fiber. Maybe they're trying some common sense things. And you've even tried, or maybe the doctor recommended some sort of dietary changes. So kudos for all of those things.
But a lot of work, yeah.
Yet something still has you concerned, has your daughter concerned. So I always say, you know, there may be worthwhile having another discussion. The question would be, who are you going to have that discussion with? If you're having it just with a pediatric gastroenterologist who has no real experience or maybe doesn't specialize in really taking care of and assessing irritable bowel disease, they may do some workup, but they may not tell you really much more than you knew beforehand. So I would really make sure it's with someone, a pediatric specialist, if you go see them, that really does work with
right.
irritable bowel syndrome. That would be an important piece. And then also it may be important to see a non-pediatric gastroenterologist, like a psychologist or a mental health provider, because a lot of times irritable bowel syndrome can have other characteristics that make it more difficult. It's a chronic disease, and that may be more difficult for your daughter and for you as well, and get some support that way.
Right. That sounds like some great advice, I think.
Well, hopefully this can help. It typically is a team here that's going to be working on this. It's not a single provider, and the pediatrician has a really good role in this case.
Right.
Thanks so much for that question. What's our next house call?
My father's been anemic for years. He's in his 80s, and he does have diabetes and high blood pressure, and what the doctors also call a touch of kidney problems. He's been on iron, which the doctor said he should take for the rest of his life, but his anemia has not changed any. Does he really need to continue taking that iron?
Well, I really do appreciate this case, because it sounds like a lot of my cases here. We have a lot of things going on simultaneously.
Right.
I don't know if you've ever seen family members, Laura, who have a lot of things going on with them.
You know? Or myself sometimes, you know. Sometimes
it
happens to all
of us. Right. We have a lot of things going on. And a touch of kidney disease. Well, you know, that's hard to know what that means. But it sounds like what we might call chronic renal insufficiency.
Okay.
Which, otherwise known as a touch of kidney disease.
Sure.
And with diabetes and hypertension, that wouldn't be unexpected.
Right.
What is interesting here is that most people who have lots of chronic illnesses may be anemic. They may have what's called anemia of chronic disease.
That's interesting.
And it's the chronic diseases cumulatively, including the kidney problems, that kind of inhibits your blood from reaching its full maximum potential. Mm-hmm. You're not going to overcome that usually with iron.
Okay.
This isn't an iron deficiency.
Right.
And so it may be that at one point in time and place, you could have been iron deficient. You may not be. The doctor can check for that easily. And if you're not iron deficient, then this iron is probably not doing you any good, and it could even do harm.
Mm-hmm.
So I would have your doctor check your iron levels, particularly a test called ferritin. And that's a kind of sees how your iron stores look like. And if you're not low in that, you don't need that iron anymore. So I would certainly not take something that, you know, iron doesn't hurt you too often, but it is constipating, mm-hmm. and iron overload syndromes can occur. You wouldn't want that.
Well, and especially if they're already dealing with multiple chronic conditions, you know, trying to pare down where you can might be something that could be a goal.
Yep. Less medicines oftentimes are better in some of our older geriatric patients mm-hmm. with multiple chronic conditions and on so many medicines if we can pare down some of those. So thank you so much for the question. What's our very last house call?
I went to see my doctor recently with low back pain that I've had for a long time, but it suddenly has gotten worse. Nothing really happened that I can pinpoint other than that the pain is now shooting down my legs. I tried taking over-the-counter Aleve, and my doctor also gave me a prescription medicine, but it didn't help. How do I know when it's time for me to get an MRI or to consult a specialist?
Well, thank you for such a simple question, Lars.
Yeah, right.
You know, we're worried too. Could this be an impingement of a disc? Mm-hmm. How likely is this? It's not likely, but we would worry. Could there be a cancer there? Could there be something, an infection? We have to think about all these things. Mm-hmm. It is most likely arthritis of the spine, impingement on a nerve. You know, I like to get people involved in physical therapy already. I like some baseline x-rays. If there haven't been any x-rays, I maybe like a simple blood test or two. Let's not go overboard in the first 2 weeks if there doesn't seem to be anything changing rapidly, but let's try to figure out what the diagnosis is.
Right.
That diagnosis is sometimes hard to know how to treat. Sometimes an MRI may be in that compendium, but maybe we'll start with the physical therapist, and if it's not better within 2 weeks, keep that in the back of our minds. If you're not getting better, go back and see your doctor.
Right.
You know, demand more. I think that's fine. Listen, our healthcare system, we don't want to really incentivize people for doing too much or too little. We want to do the right thing in the right amount, the right dose, the right place for the right person.
And what kind of specialist, other than maybe, you know, you mentioned physical therapy, but what other kind of specialist might a primary care physician send you to see for this?
Sometimes I really like seeing an appointment with a physiatrist or a physical medicine and rehab specialist. They usually don't do surgery, so they'll be approaching it from a, I think, a holistic viewpoint and help pinpoint the diagnosis. If I think it's a surgical, then I'm going to probably send you an orthopedist or a neurosurgeon. But if it's not, I don't really want to necessarily send you to those people because you don't really want to have surgery if you didn't need it.
Yeah, if you don't need surgery, avoid it.
So this is a starting place for a good conversation, and want to thank all of our listeners today for their questions about their health. And we hope we've addressed issues that are important to your health. You can follow us and ask us questions at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. I want to thank our great guest today, Dr. Brian Fallon. And we hope you'll join us again next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we'll look forward to seeing you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.